Hello and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. We're about halfway through our summer blockbuster season, where we're bringing you Art of the Cut episodes twice a week. I hope you've been enjoying the double shot of editorial goodness each week. By the end of this month, we'll have completed our 300th Art of the Cut interview. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. Today, we're speaking with Marco Capalbo, an editor with a long-term collaborative relationship with Werner Herzog. Most recently, they worked together on the documentary Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds. Their collaboration has also included Nomad, In the Footsteps of Bruce Chatwin, Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World, and The Killers Unstaged. Tell me a little bit about the latest project you've worked on. It's a documentary, correct?
It is a documentary called Fireball. And it is a documentary about meteors and asteroids and all of that kind of stuff. The subtitle is Visitors from Darker Worlds. Very Herzogian subtitle and title, I guess.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, the director is Werner Herzog, with a co-director on this project, Clive Oppenheimer, who is a British, I think he's really a geologist, but has scientific knowledge, I guess, that Werner might not have had.
And you've worked with Werner a lot, correct?
I've worked with him a lot, yes. Not our first project. We've been working together, I think, 8 or 9 years at this point. So we've done a number of different projects.
Do you remember starting that relationship, how it began and why that relationship started?
It started through a mutual friend who is a cinematographer who did some shooting on, he's worked on a few of Werner's films, although not recently, I think. And that was a shorter project, also documentary, about the band called The Killers. And Werner was directing a live stream, I think it was for American Express. They did a series of live stream concerts with different directors doing it. And The Killers had asked for Werner. Werner, of course, had never heard of The Killers, but then they were from Vegas, and so that helped. And anyway, there was about a 15 or 20 minute film that was part of the live stream. I think it went on before, I can't quite remember, kind of documentary about them that Werner did. So I was brought on to do that. And then we did 4 Death Row films. We've done a number of other things. Fireball, most recently, just before that, we did a documentary for the BBC. So anyway, we go back quite some years.
To me, and I don't know his entire filmography, but those seem to be films that are more like him than a film about fireballs. Tell me about how that happened and why this is a Werner Herzog movie.
Right. Well, of course, you'd have to ask him to know that for sure, but I think that all of Werner's docs and his films, I suppose, there's a kind of a curiosity about the world. So if a topic comes in at him, as for me, I would say, we kind of get immersed in it, get interested in it. Of course, this topic of fireballs has an element that people maybe rightly or wrongly associate with Werner, which is that it has a dark, cataclysmic end of the world kind of a feel to it also. But that's really only part of it. Actually, it has a very humanistic kind of take on this. It is not by any means a National Geographic type of film with just strict scientific stuff and history. And of course, those elements are in there, but that's not the focus of the film. Well, I guess you could, I was going to say, if you didn't know anything about meteors, yeah, you're going to learn some things. That's certainly true. But it has a much more personal take, I think, on what these things have meant, could mean in the future, etc.
I would think that it's kind of hard to visualize. What kind of either assistance did you provide to say, oh, you know, I need these elements, or were they simply always provided for you? Like, I'm working on a documentary right now where I'm finding that I need to ask the director for a lot of things. We've shot this much stuff, but I think that we need this to make this transition or to make this scene more interesting.
Right. Well, in this film, again, because there was, I suppose you could say the decision, if you want to call it that, that this was not going to try to be that National Geographic film. So we were not looking for, oh, we're going to have to animate this, or we're going to have to do this. So more it was trying to find what visual elements we could use that were already out there. And these fell into two categories. There are, in fact, with one source in particular, there's great footage. There was a big meteorite fall, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. I can't remember. 2013 is what pops in my head. That may be wrong, but somewhere in that range. In Siberia that fell.
And, I remember that.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, it seems like a lot of Russian drivers have dash cams in their cars. I don't know the what the backstory of that is, but it's kind of a thing. I don't know if it's because they drive quite wildly or whatever it is. But anyway, there's a tremendous amount of dash cam footage of guys who were just driving around quite early in the morning in Siberia. So guys just who were driving to work or whatever they're doing. And suddenly it is a spectacular, large, unmistakable thing that comes shooting across. I mean, it's almost blinding to the eye. It's so bright. So there was that, and also security cam footage, similarly in that area that people found. It all got put on YouTube over the years. So we had access to that stuff. Of course, they had to, once we took pieces, they had to go find whoever wanted to and that kind of thing. But not my job, thank God. I do have to keep track of where everything comes from, obviously. But there was that. And then there have been a number of Hollywood films that have tackled the subject, again, usually on these, Earth-destroying...
Armageddon-type things.
Actually, I think one of them is called Armageddon. But the one that we liked the best and ended up using about, somewhere under a minute of footage from, is a film called Deep Impact. And that has a very spectacular crash or blast and then city wiped out, New York City being tsunami, all this kind of stuff, which Werner found is would seem to be against Werner's aesthetic in one respect, but actually is not. And he takes great pleasure in seeing how something like that can be done. And it's done amazingly well. So we used that. We also had, I don't think it was National Geographic, but a more scientific doc, which we took from, which had a frankly rather ludicrous visualization of the dinosaurs being eliminated, which was something that happened tens of millions of years ago, complete with what's considered the largest meteor strike that has been determined to have happened, which was down in Mexico.
Yep, the Gulf of Mexico.
Chicxulub, yeah, now Cancun. So we had footage from that, which showed the dinosaurs in a very kind of Disney way, kind of look, here comes this thing. Oh. So we actually left it in. The commentary is particularly amusing there. So Werner found it kind of, it's a comic, almost comic moment, but it actually does show this thing wiped out most life on Earth at that time through, it was devastating. I think that one was 10 or 12 kilometers across. I mean, that's a big, big sucker. And I guess it's the last largest one that's hit us. But as people point out in the film, inevitably another will. The time span is what's get interesting. It could be in the next 100 million years. There's no reason to think it'll be in the next few years. It won't.
What are you doing to help him stay in the right tone? With footage coming from all over the place, it still has to be his film.
Right.
And feel like him and feel like the rest of the film. How are you able to regulate that tone, help him manage that?
Right. I think that that's an interesting question. Because we have a couple of other things to say about Werner films, which is sort of known about him, is that there's very little conventional B-roll. And the B-roll that there is quite specific. Now, there's a scene in the film, which I think is very typical, you could say, in a way, of Werner, and that is made very much in the editing. And there's a scene there which uses a piece of B-roll that was shot I don't want to say it was shot accidentally. That's not true. But it would seem to have nothing whatever to do with the film. In fact, I think most people would say, oh, well, we definitely don't need that. There was a famous and an important meteor that had fallen in 1492, actually, in France, that became, at that time, people saw these things as signals from God, or did they have a portent, did they have a meaning, did they have all this kind of stuff. So this is all being discussed. And in the little town there in Alsace, there's a museum which houses the remains of this stone. It's about, a few feet across, whatever, quite a large thing, fallen in a field. Completely separate from that, but also, it's like in the town hall kind of thing, tiny little town. Next to it, another part of the museum, there's a completely unrelated installation. Very odd installation, which has a statue, a bust of a man who's a coal miner. He's got the miner's hat on, the light on. And through this kind of low-tech, high-tech, they project a film onto the wall that also makes it seem as if he comes to life, because this bust starts speaking. He is not speaking about the meteor whatsoever. It never comes up. He's talking about the fact that this town used to be a mining town where they mined, I forget what it is, borax or something, some mineral. He never mentions meteors. It has nothing to do with meteors. It's in a separate part of the museum. And I think most filmmakers would say, yeah, well, we definitely don't need that. But however it happened, that got filmed. So we're sitting in the editing and we're looking at the footage of the museum that did have to do with the stove and a few guys there and so on. Now we come to this thing. And I think, again, most, well, certainly in a National Geographic film, that's out. No conceivable place for it. But in this film, it's kind of, aha, what can we do with this? Also because we knew that we needed another thing that I think is important in the editing, particularly the film this kind, is to regulate the information. Because there is a lot of technical scientific subject, and there's scientists talking about different things, and you could just get overwhelmed with this stuff. So you definitely need a moment to kind of step back. And in this case, there's a Herzogian moment. It's a moment of sort of humor, and yet it does inform the whole thing. What we did there is that Werner narrates what this figure, the simulacrum, as he calls it, says, except it's not at all what he says. It's completely fabricated. And we simply use the imagery, which shows, for example, a mine, and there seems to be some kind of explosion going on. Well, it has nothing to do with meteors. But now, in this revoiced narration, this miner is not a miner at all, but he's someone who the town, when the big meteor hit, which it never did. But when the big meteor hit, they all went down in the mines and lived down there and were the last and only survivors of the human species. It's a complete fantasy that has nothing to do, but it comes in the context of things. Just before it, in fact, we see in the museum, they have there a book, which is a book by Jules Verne, French writer, who wrote about some kind of, I forget which book it is. You know, he did
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah, Journey to the Center of the Earth and this kind of thing. So, I mean, there is a history of fabrication, of storytelling around these apocalyptic things. So now we simply add the next chapter to it. And I think that's where you can say, to get back to your question, is that, yes, this is a scientific documentary, but it's a Werner Herzog film. Therefore, it's going to be about something else as well. I mean, it has key things about the topic in a scientific, quite straight way, but it has a take on it, which is unique to Werner, I think. So to your question, yes, we're looking for, and I'm helping him to shape those moments which stray outside of the apparent topic. And in the end, it is those things which really are the topic, because I don't think I'm saying anything against the film to say, if you just want absolutely the textbook about meteors, this is probably not a place to start. Now, as I said, it has a lot of information that may or may not be in other films. So not to say it doesn't have that, but it ends up with a much more humanistic view of it and tying together elements. Another element which goes to your found footage or archival footage, which we had to handle very carefully, actually, which is that, you may not know this, but that the big black, it's called the Kaaba, which is the holiest site, I think, in the world of Islam, is the thing that they make the pilgrimage to in Mecca. It's a big black cube.
Yep, and they walk around and around and around.
Correct. And you're to do this once in your life. What I didn't know before that is that actually, well, what is that big thing and why is it there? Well, the corner of it has a stone, not the big black. I mean, the big black thing is a constructed temple, essentially. It's a hollow, empty thing. But in the corner of that black thing on the outside is a stone that is apparently, although not proven, but is considered to be a meteorite, placed there by Muhammad years ago. So that's the thing, when they go around it, you're to touch and or kiss that stone within the stone. It has kind of a silver frame around it. So in the context of talking about how mediums have had important cultural impact through time, including religious, etc. So we wanted to have a sequence that would get into this topic. Now, for a variety of reasons, one wants to tread a bit carefully there. They did not shoot there, although there was discussion of it. So we found some footage, quite conventional footage of the place of Mecca and all this, and the people around the stone and all of that. That's all been shot perfectly well. You could get that footage, no problem. But what we really wanted was something that got us to that stone, the actual meteorite stone. And that was much harder to find. And in the end, I just looked on YouTube and found, in fact, someone with a cell phone who was a pilgrim, had gone there and shot the crowd. I mean, it's teeming with people. It's kind of ecstatic. I mean, within inches of it, this was the footage. We had to have this footage. Now, that was a challenge. How do you track that back and find? Well, through YouTube and whatever, the guy who shot that footage was a pilgrim. I mean, they're dead serious about what they're doing there. So sure. He did not want this footage, if there was any possibility that it could put Islam or him or anything in any kind of a negative light, then no way possible. But various calls and whatnot were made. Eventually, we were granted permission to use this footage. It's kind of amazing footage that really is not seen in a film. Now, you could say, yeah, everybody sees on YouTube, you see everything anyway. So that's true. But to be able to incorporate it into something, and again, with, I think this goes to your original question of how the stays of Werner film, which does come to the editing sense in moments like that. I think in a lot of films, it might not allow the time to really let that be a real thing, as opposed to just, oh, here's a little snippet of that to show, well, people go there and then you see that and that's it. This actually, we linger there. We spend the time to actually experience it as the guy had. And I think that's something in a more conventional, if that's the right word, film, that time might not be used in that way.
That's really tricky to try to create a cohesive film with all these disparate elements. What are some of those tricks, or what are some of the problem-solving things that you're using to try to make that be cohesive?
Right. That's a good question. I think, again, because of Werner's, and now he and I work, I don't know if he works the same way with other people or not, but I know how he and I work, which is that we're certainly not working to a script. So we're kind of creating the scenes. And I think that's a word that applies maybe more to a documentary by Werner than it might other documentaries, where they are like scenes almost in a narrative film. They have the characters and we kind of introduce them and we learn who they are and then we get to what their contribution to the thing is. So then we're having a number of these stitched together to get a flow through the whole film. And how does one topic lead to the next coherently, when in this case, it's not a historical story where you say, okay, well, now we're just going to tell the story of this person, and that's the story of the film. So the narrative is kind of laid out. I think this film was a bit of a challenge in that regard. this narrative spans, I mean, literally hundreds of millions of years. The earliest things that we're talking about are that long ago. We're talking about things in the future. We're talking about huge events on a very big scale, but we're also talking about very, very small things. And it was shot in, I think I counted, six continents. It's in America, Australia, Europe, Antarctica, Asia also, and Hawaiian Island. I mean, they were all over the place, really the whole world, and outer space, actually, because we have footage that came from NASA, I guess, but there's footage from a Japanese spacecraft, which, believe it or not, I did not know this had happened. It just happened very recently, has landed a small craft on an asteroid and collected sample and is bringing it back. It's mind-blowing. So in order to regulate that, there isn't really a thread in a conventional way. We had to be able to just feel it out and imagine, okay, well, now that we're on this topic, would it make sense to now go to this next topic? What are the connecting tissues? Because, as I said, there's not a narrative in the normal sense. The narrative is to take these different views of this topic and eventually to try to bring it to some conclusion. And the conclusion that the film comes to is, I think, quite an unusual one. And maybe that, again, is something that Werner would encourage the film to have that someone else might not. That we got to at the end, it comes to a very small island in the Pacific somewhere where shooting stars or fireballs or whatever you want to call it is part of the kind of mythology of these very native people who see it as a part of spiritual progress, that when you die, you go on to one of these things and get shot off into space. And they have a whole sort of dance, a fire dance, which they do, and is performed for the first time in 50 years for this film. And that's the end point. That's where the film lands up. In a sense, it's the least scientific, it's a totally non-scientific moment of the film. But in a way, it encapsulates all of that, because in the end, we are humans. There's a multiplicity of understanding.
You mentioned that there's no script. How do you know what to do every day? I'm working on a documentary, so I understand what could happen. But for example, at the beginning, there were interviews shot, or did you start going, okay, I have this scene. There is this scene of the fire dancing or whatever it is. I will just worry about the fire dancing scene.
Right. Well, there are two things to say about that. One is, and I think this is a known thing about Werner, but if it isn't, you're hearing about it now, which is that not only is there no script, there are no transcripts. And transcripts are forbidden.
Wow. Now, transcripts are forbidden. Okay.
Forbidden. Now, to say that there's no transcript in the conventional sense. Every other documentary I work on, the first thing is, I burn a time code and ship it off to the transcribers, and it comes back. And now everybody has a document with this stuff. This is the part that we are free from. What Werner and I do in the first days of editing, I would say the most grueling part of the process, he's been doing it for years. I now do it with him, and I do it on other films, is to by hand log the footage, which is not a transcription because it's not word for word, but enough that it's like a half transcription. But it requires looking at all the footage, which you would think, everybody looks at all the footage. No, they don't. Nobody looks at all the footage. You know that, and I know that. But most people do not look at the footage, meaning they actually just sit there and every second of it watch. The thing about a transcript, a conventional transcript, is twofold. One is that it can miss the great moments, which on paper, just nothing. The guy's, answered a question and said yes. That's what the transcript said. You look at the footage, the guy had a mental breakdown and, some tremendous reaction that doesn't appear in the transcript. And if you were just looking, skimming through the transcript, you might fly right past that. The other side of that is things which in the transcript seem to be fascinating and incredible, but you look at the footage, you're like, man, that guy seems to be asleep when he's saying that. The advantage of doing it the way we're doing it is that we're already making selections and certainly things which are from that moment of seeing them, are this will be in the film. This moment here will be in the film. We don't know where, we don't know what it's going to do, but that's going to be in the film for sure. And most often, it does end up in the final cut of the film. There are things that are just so amazing for reasons that we don't know. How's it going to fit in? No idea. What's the topic going to be? Don't know yet. But that's good right here. And so we need that somewhere. And it almost, you could say, it's almost working around it to say, well, we know we want that. How do we get into it? And again, it's almost a more narrative approach that you would do in a narrative film, to say in a scene, whoa, this take here, this guy did whatever. We know we got to find a way to get that in there. So it's almost as if we're doing that. And then, well, in this film, it's also was true that things, particularly in this case, as I said, was shot over such a wide geographical area. And it was over some period of time. It was not all shot in session. They kind of did some stuff here, and then we got that footage. And so some of the time, the footage is coming in, I'm getting it first. But basically, we were able to kind of go scene by scene, not yet knowing how the scenes might accumulate. That goes to your question. What are you doing day by day without knowing? Yes, we're not following the script. There are points, I would say, in the process where we definitely take a conscious step back and say, all right, well, what do we got? All right, we got this, then this kind of blocks, you could say. And, you know, is this, yeah, maybe this should block, should come before. But there's a bit of a swapping around in that way. And of course, then we have to look for redundancy. Mm-hmm. But generally, I think there is something to this idea that there's a key moment, perhaps, in a given scene, in a given interview, or on a given topic that we know is going to be in the film. And there is a kind of a way of, all right, well, how do we arrive at it so that we'll get the most out of it?
How to utilize it. And what are you doing when you find those moments? How are you organizing? Are you putting that stuff in a bin and a selects reel? Do you stick it on a card and put it on a wall?
No, nothing like that. Again, in the log, I think each of us has our language. Again, this is a handwritten thing. In Werner's case, he does it in a book. I think all of his films, he has this log book, he calls it. I do it on loose paper so that then I can put it in a binder and I can move it around. I can then order it as I want to have access to it. But there's time code for everything on there. And then there are various marks to say, well, this is a must be, this is a maybe. So later when each of us is going through, it's very quick to go, oh yeah, what about that moment? I have marked to this moment that time code's there, boom, I can pop it up. We look at it again. Ah, yeah, that's good. Let's put this now. And the thing is kind of assembled that way. I don't do cards with Werner, certainly. Particularly once we've got a bit of the film assembled, then to be able to step back at it, as I say, and look at it. And I might make a list there that we can look at and say, okay, we've got this, this, this. Sort of showing what the form of the flow of it is at that point. So we don't have to watch the whole thing over and over to kind of see it. We can see it quickly on paper and say, okay, right, it goes from this to this to this. And then maybe questions come up, yeah, might we be better to go to that before that, or that kind of thing, and moving chunks around.
How did you determine the beginning of the film? Did you know that final fire dance scene was going to go at the end and you did something at the beginning to lead to it?
Yeah, I guess we did know that. We knew that pretty early. And there's a second dance that actually is at the beginning, and that bookends the film. And that's also a kind of a fire dance, although it's funny because it would seem as if it has exactly to do with our topic, but there's no way that it could. In the town of Chicxulub, which is where the biggest, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs and 90% of all life, that town, obviously the town wasn't there then, the town that's there now, also has Mayan temples nearby, etc. And there is a Mayan fireball. They do a kind of a game. It looks like not exactly basketball, but done with a fiery ball. I don't know what that thing is made of, but it's flaming. And they throw it to each other and they toss it through a hoop, actually. And there are huge crowds, and they do it on the Day of the Dead. So it's somehow all connected. that. The Maya knew nothing about the fact that a big meteor had fallen there. There's no way they could have known. They didn't. So that's our film starts with that. Starts with that fire dance and ends with this other fire dance, which kind of, again, brings it together in a more human level rather than just, oh, it's just a scientist talking about this and this and this. You know, things which are more evocative of, again, as the Maya, it actually has nothing to do with the topic, but visually it does. And there is a connection between the Maya and the large asteroid. Not that they knew that that was the connection, but I don't know if you know this, the water holes that are there in the Yucatan Peninsula. I said Cancun before, Yucatan is what I said. There are these water holes called cenotes, which people dive into, and they know about through that, the huge circle, about a 100-mile circle. In fact, they were created as a result of the impact tens of millions of years before.
The jettisoned material from that impact.
Yeah, and it caused the crust to sink and something and whatever. You cannot see a crater. It's way, way too long ago. And actually, it's only in the last, I think, 40 plus or minus years that it's actually ever been figured out that that's what was going on there, and that is where the meteor did fall.
So much of what you talked about, and I think about this with Werner Films, is what the subtext is, that so often the documentary is not about the topic, it's about the subtext. How did you discuss that, or how did he discuss that with you, and then how did that affect your editing to understand what the subtext was?
I think it guided us in two ways. One is that the interviews themselves, although in this case, the interviews were not conducted by Werner, but were conducted by Clive Oppenheimer. He was actually sometimes on camera and sometimes not, but mostly on camera. So, but I think he and Werner had discussed what would be kinds of questions that would be asked. And I think the direction of the film is already in motion there, because the questions are leading into topics which are not the conventional, which go more to your subtext idea. They're not just simply on, okay, give us the fact, give us the science, give us the technical answer to everything. That's there where it's needed, but there's already an awareness that this film is not only about that. And I think, in fact, you can say the film is ultimately not about that. It's about the subtext of this thing. Just how have these meteors and so forth impacted us as humans, how they changed our culture, how are we live? Our world is very much actually created by them in a funny way. And ultimately, even suggested, and there is research ongoing, is it possible that actually our very lives, life itself, is created by them? There's people looking into that, and there's evidence to suggest that could well be. So that goes to very big topics. So we knew, and we know as we're editing, that those big topics are there, that your subtext, although not gotten at directly, because I think it would be very hard to do to walk into an interview and just immediately, okay, so how does this impact the big, you can't get at that big question that way, I think. It's better to get at those big topics indirectly, by the subtext, also to allow the viewer to arrive at some of those connections himself. That keeps the viewer engaged. It's not just being told, okay, think this, here's what this is, here's what this is, and this is our opinion of the topic, and boom, that's it. And I think that's the benefit of doing it in an indirect way. For example, by ending with this fire dance, we're not saying it's not in Werner's narration, oh, and here's what, here I am, here we are, tying it all together. This proves it didn't. It's nothing like that. We allow the people to speak for themselves, the people who are doing this dance. And we've kicked up a lot of this topic all over the place. And now you see it and you make your own conclusion of it, particularly as the film ends with these embers of a fire disappearing up into the sky. That's a visual connection being made. You know, we're not underlining it with saying, okay, so here it is, and this day, you know, it's, as you say, subtext is a much more powerful conveyor, I think, of the true meaning. So.
And how does that affect your pacing? Because I just watched a documentary last night where one of the characters said something that was pretty profound. And I don't think they landed on it too hard or anything, but after that character said something, there was a very deliberate pause. They went to a shot, no dialogue, no music, and I thought, that is so I can think about what I just heard. What moments did you feel, I need to give the audience some time here?
I think that's something that we're very conscious of in the editing. And even there's a word that, I don't know where it originated, but with Werner and me, but it's a word that we find ourselves using a lot, which is the word of that something needs to linger. And that can be a number of different kinds of things, but particularly, I think in this film, it's two different types. One is simply, there's just an overwhelming amount of information, and we know, okay, let's just shut up for a minute here and let people just absorb, stop for a second. They can't take any more in. There's that kind of a thing, which might be then a moment of just a pure visual material. There's a moment, for example, where we have looking through a microscope at some slices of a meteor, and they have a kind of amazing pattern look through a microscope. And so we've heard a lot about this whole topic and what they could be and this and that. And yeah, we just, you know, let's just look at these things for a while. Let's say anything. And someone, you can look at them. They're just a pretty pattern, whatever. It just allow you to just absorb that kind of information. That's one kind of a thing. But I think there's also the type, which may be more what you were just talking about, where there's really quite a profound thought about something that you really need to wrap your mind around. Not a technical, okay, I've got a lot of technical, not that, but that other kind of a big, maybe it's a subtext, right, to use subtext. That word there. More of a subtext thing that's come at you that you want to let that, again, using the word linger, or resonate or something like that, that allows the audience to ponder that and before we go on to the next thing. And that, I would say, it's funny you're talking about, there's no music, no nothing. I think we use, because there's not, I don't want to say never, but let's say almost never would there be in this film anyway music during any kind of an interview. I think I could say that there never is.
Mm-hmm. So then those microscope moments would be places where
music... Exactly. Happens. Because music can get that kind of mood instantly, which is another benefit, which I can talk about a bit in terms of how music is used in the film. So I think this is a little different too. Has again the advantage, and I should name check here, the team that is working on this film, myself included, are people, collaborators that Vern has worked with multiple times before in all cases. The DP... I've cut a number of films that he's shot. He must have shot 20 films or whatever, a high number. The composer in this case, for most of the music, is also a composer that Vern has worked with many times, a Dutch cellist composer, Ernst Reisiger. I know him now through working on these films. The music is available to us almost from day one. And the music is going into the film very early on and becomes part of the film very early on.
So you're not temping.
We're not temping. I mean, occasionally, for one reason or another, something might change a bit or a different version of the same thing in his case. And we used a couple of cues in this that were not by him. And I think there was one where we had to swap out later because of rights issues. But basically, for the majority of the cases, that music is available to us very, very early. And we're using it and putting it in there and becomes part of the scene day one. Really, from or the earliest part of the editing. Now, in this film, because as I say, I want to say there's barely any music. I can't remember if there could be a moment for this, but essentially, there's no music during any of the interviews. So the music is coming in precisely these moments, more reflective moments that have to do with allowing our audience to digest and to linger with what we've said. The one other case of the music is to allow the music to help us build the scene to a more kind of poetic moment. There's a scene in Antarctica, which has this, you know, tremendous visual there, this incredible landscape, this otherworldly landscape. And in fact, Antarctica, as I certainly did not know, although once you think about it, it makes sense, is the hunting ground for meteorites. Why? because meteorites are falling everywhere all the time. They're all over the place, but I would be fine. There, if there's a rock on the surface, it can't be anything else. Where else could it have come from? Because it's just sheer ice. So the only place it could be, in fact, they're pushed up. It's a much bigger process. They haven't just necessarily landed there, but essentially they go there, these, you know, meteor hunters, and they go there in these expeditions to find these things. And they have a whole system. It looks like in cop films where there's a crime scene and you get that row of cops walking through a field looking for, well, this is the same. You get a row spread out basically as far so that each has the maximum field of their vision, I guess about 20 feet in each direction or so, spread out. But so this leads to a long-winded way of getting to this rather more poetic use of music and image, which I think we use to maximum effect there. Again, we kind of veer off the topic a little bit, but again, to arrive at the subtext, which is how mankind is a very small thing. And there's this vastness which we can experience here. There's a moment of Verna's narration where we see a man, one of our guys, walking in search of these things, the ice as far as you can see. And as Verna says, you could continue to walk straight ahead for 4,000 kilometers and you will encounter nothing. But that gives a sense of our scale within this much bigger universe, which is also true for, that's the subtext of how little we know, if you want to say that, or how little we are in comparison to these things, including these stones falling out of the sky that are just part of this much, much bigger thing that we are along for the ride on.
I spoke to a group of NYU students this morning, and one of them said she was working on a documentary and was feeling incredibly overwhelmed. Just there's a lot of material, there's no organization of it as there would be in a scripted narrative, and she didn't have a clue where to start. What advice would you have for this woman?
Just start is the first
exactly
thing.
That's exactly what I told her. That is exactly what I told her. You just have to start someplace.
You have to start someplace. I think, again, if you're working, which I have to say I prefer in a doc to work without a script because it's more challenging. So my advice would be just start, but be as aware as you can be and really pay attention to what you have and let what you have guide you to the next thing and let that inform, because then you'll have something which organically leads you rather than something that's just on paper, which again goes to that transcript idea. Yeah, it may look good on paper, but it's always stronger if you could say you just started. All right, well, I've got this guy. Here's this guy talking about something. Or here's an image of something. What does that suggest to me? And then you make the connections. Oh, yeah, right. I remember seeing that other image of whatever. Let's go get that. Now you suddenly start building the thing. The other thing is don't look back. Just keep going forward.
It's like when you're up climbing Yosemite Half Moon, you're like, don't look down.
Right. Don't look down, exactly, because otherwise you'll never get to the end, ever. If after you've got your little scene, you're already back at the beginning of it, you'll never get out of it. So you just get that. All right, now just put the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And eventually you'll have something big enough that you can now step back from. Say, okay, I see what it is now. And then maybe you have to move things around or whatever.
To some extent, I think of that fact of getting overwhelmed or not knowing where to start. I think some of it is a sense of patience that you need to just do something and realize you're not going to be productive immediately and that that's okay. That all you're going to do is watch the film and not even know what to do. That's fine. Just watch the film.
Exactly.
That's one of the reasons why when I'm working, sometimes even on narrative, I will try to watch dailies or watch footage that I know I'm not going to cut that night. I just watch it and then I go home.
Right. Just to let it sink in a bit.
Yeah. Any other tips like that about not getting overwhelmed? How do you organize material inside your project? Are you in an Avid?
I'm Avid, yeah. You know, I have my system. Well, system is wrong.
What's the system?
I mean, you know, I don't know. Well, one thing that it's, and I think it is particular to Avid, which is why I would never switch, is that, and this is purely technical speak, but maybe some of your audience is a technical audience.
Everybody likes it, yep.
for me, the key way to edit is that I edit from sequence to sequence. Mm-hmm. If you do Avid, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
So
a lot of Premiere editors do the same thing.
You can do it in Premiere.
Oh, 100%. Yep.
Yeah, okay. I know you couldn't do it in Final Cut Pro, which is the only older one. Do a little bit at one time. I don't
so you edit from sequence to sequence. So you're creating a selects correct. Reel of some kind, or
correct? Yeah. For example, B-roll just all goes, maybe not for the whole film, but for one section or one topic or one something. Or if, let's say that I've gone to find archival footage and I have all people, it gets shipped in to me. Also, the producers are looking for it. They're tossing bins of stuff. Most of it useless, but you know they're tending to just get everything. So now 100 clips, you want two. But in order to quickly be able to look through stuff, if I'm always going, oh, here's a clip, here's a clip. No, I just take them all, boom, I put them in one sequence. And now it's just one whole long 1 hour movie. I just zip through very quickly and land on something. And if need be, I can mark something there as, this was good, this was good. But so I arrange things always quickly into sequences and then I'm cutting from those so that I have either related material is grouped together. Once I've done all the syncing and all that stuff, which I was doing that first, and then creating sequences of that. But if there were, for example, a number of interviews which are somehow related, or want that, they'll be in one sequence. I don't need to think of them as separate things now. They're already part of one thing.
Yep. All the asteroid hunters in Antarctica walking across the ice is a
exactly.
sequence.
Boom, that's all right there. Now, you would think normally the editor opinion is, oh, you want as much of everything at all times as possible. I don't subscribe to that. In fact, you can go the other way. This goes back more to Werner's, and he's very much, he goes, really gets upset if someone, they say, oh, well, he sends, you know, there's a researcher, let's say, he's going to go to a library and they have photographs of meteors or something. They will come back with every photograph in the museum, you know that, and there's going to be 1,000 of them. This drives him and me to distraction. And I think it might be because he's, in a way, thinking as an editor. He says, the way you do it is you go in there, I want this one, and this one. Done. With the proviso that later, we're not going to cry, gee, I wish we had all. No, we're going to use this one, and that's it. The selection has already been made. That's an extreme example. He definitely, and again, working with the same cinematographer that he's worked with a lot, is well-versed on this. The B-roll is very specific. So I'm not wading through hundreds and hundreds of shots that you're just looking at as just the garbage. And now you're there lingering around. So I don't have that problem. There tends to be fewer things. It's a much more manageable amount. And the filtering has already happened.
Yeah, the filtering is the other thing that keeps you from getting overwhelmed.
Yes, exactly. And I think you need to be bold about it. And be willing to say, okay, I'm going with this shot. And well, I might use this one. I might do this. No, make your choice. Make it strong. Take a strong choice and move with that. And not be looking back constantly. Oh, should I go back? Maybe there was a better shot. Maybe there was this. You're already going backwards. And I think the key is to keep going this direction, which is something I appreciate, again, very much working with Werner. He goes along with that viewpoint of moving forward as much as possible. Of course, there are times you have to look back and do things. But as a philosophy, and I think as a way not to get overwhelmed, if you make strong choices and you stick by them, maybe you come to a point later where you say, well, okay, there is that one thing and maybe I should redo that. Okay, fair enough. You would not have gotten there in the first place if you're not willing to make those strong choices and live with them.
Amen.
And be open to what they tell you and let them guide you to the next step. Really see what you've got. Keep moving forward.
A great way to finish this interview. Thank you, Marco, for some really great wisdom about editing, and I look forward to seeing the film sometime soon.
Thank you, Steve, and I look forward to chatting with you again on the next project.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. Also, it's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut: Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated experience. Thanks to my guest, Marco Capalbo. Thanks also to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. Thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast, and I'd love for you to review this podcast as well. Finally, if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.